Today's episode is sponsored by AARP. The latest issue of Politico magazine series, The Deciders, takes a look at voters over 50 in Pennsylvania who are being crushed by the cost of healthcare. Visit politico.com/thedeciders to learn more.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Politico's Nerdcast. I'm Scott Bland, your host. This week on the show, we'll put some bonkers fundraising numbers into context. Spoiler alert, it was good news for Democrats. We'll talk about what happened, some of the historical context here, and also lay out the argument that Republicans are making for why maybe this won't matter as much as some people think. Plus, we are going to dive into President Trump's sense of humor and showmanship and how it plays on the midterm campaign roadshow. One of our White House reporters has been digging into just how and why Trump performs the way he does as he's ramping up all these rallies across the country before the midterm elections. Before we begin, a quick note, Nerdcast will be at Politicon this weekend. It's the convention for political junkies. It's in Los Angeles, October 21st and 22nd, and you can come see us on Saturday as we do a live taping there. You've not truly experienced the Nerdcast until you see Charlie Mattesian in person. Tickets and more info are available at politicon.com. Also, stay tuned for the end of this episode for a contribution from one of the Nerdcast's biggest fans. And as always, a reminder that we're taping this a little bit before noon Eastern on Thursday, October 18th, so it's all up to date as of then. No members of Congress have been indicted yet today. All right, let's get started. I want to welcome our guests. As previously mentioned, we have senior politics editor Charlie Mattesian here as always. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Scott.
And our House campaign reporter and FEC filing expert, Elena Schneider, is also here in the studio. Hi, Elena.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Thanks so much for coming back from Minnesota for the podcast.
They finally let me go. They threatened to take away my ID, but I got away.
All right. So, Elena, let's jump into our first data point.
I'm really going to make a lot of friends with Minnesota and South Dakota this year.
Our first data point is the number 92, and that's how many Democratic challengers running for the House outraised Republican incumbents in the last 3 months. 92 Democrats in 92 Republican-held House districts. That's according to Federal Election Commission figures that were out this week that were due on Monday. In a typical year, the number of incumbents who get outraised is just a handful. And the number of incumbents who end up having less cash in the bank for the last month of the campaign is even more minuscule. But this year, as it has been in so many other ways, is breaking all sorts of campaign finance norms, Elena. Can you put that in context for us, just how outside the norm it is?
Absolutely. This is insane. That's the context. It's insane. So just to run through the numbers just a little more deeply. So as you said, 92 Republican incumbents were outraised. On top of that, 33 had less cash on hand, which is always sort of the number that whoever's getting outraised likes to point to of, you know, okay, we're your outraised, but actually we really have more. This is like the money you have in the bank, money that you have access to that you can use and spend. So normally incumbents still have an edge there. 33 are behind their Democratic opponents in cash on hand. 61 Democrats raised more than $1 million, and at least half of those people raised more than $2 million. Again, that's insane. I don't think that there is not a historical comparison for this moment in time in terms of small dollar fundraising that Democrats have been able to tap into in an extraordinary way. And look, money isn't everything. I think Jeb Bush taught us that. Hillary Clinton has taught us that. John Ossoff taught us that. But I do think that sort of the breadth and width and depth of the amount of money that's come in is a sign of enthusiasm. And it's also, and it gives candidates an ability to get out their message in a way that in other years has been a lot more difficult. Mm-hmm. And people can decide whether or not they like that message. But at least, at the very least, the problem isn't going to be about budget for these candidates. And that is really key.
And I think there's an interesting point to be made about the small dollar donations, that this is, it's not just about the money. This is an example of enthusiasm that matters in midterm elections, right? It typically, you know, it seems like we're going to have a very high turnout election, but turnout is never as high as it is in a presidential year. And this is a measure of how engaged a lot of Democratic supporters are. And also, with regard to that cash on hand figure, you know, we looked back at the historical data, and you know, there haven't been that many of them, but 2/3 of the incumbents in the last decade who have trailed in cash on hand at this point went on to lose. So that's been like a really dire historical sign.
Yeah, another historical sign being that back in 2010, which was the Republican wave election, that year 18 House Democrats finished the third quarter with less cash on hand than their opponents, and 10 went on to lose. So again, it's not a perfect indicator. Obviously, some people are going to be able to survive this, but it gives you just sort of a window into, as you say, the intensity and the willingness to participate in elections that you may not even be voting in. And I think that that's really worrying, at least to some Republican fundraisers that I've talked to, who say these are people who are now invested in a party, and that makes you more likely to vote and makes you more likely to continue to participate. And that's not something Republican candidates have done as good of a job on, because they've been more reliant on sort of these big money mega donors like Sheldon Adelson, sort of the names of the Koch brothers, the names we always hear. And those people can only vote once. And, you know, the hundreds of thousands of people who have donated can all vote themselves.
Charlie, this is one of many data points that we've been talking about a lot this year, going back into 2017, actually. One of many factors that just objectively look like things lining up for a good Democratic year and potentially a takeover of the House of Representatives. But I want to ask you to argue the other side. You know, what's the path for the GOP holding on to a slim House majority, which is something that a lot of Republicans are saying they can see happening, especially if some things break their way over the next few weeks?
I can't believe you just gave me that burning dumpster fire of a question after these new FEC numbers. No, actually, I mean, there is a sort of, vaguely plausible argument you can make here about how Republicans sort of salvage the majority, or at least don't get blown out of the water. I mean, I happen to be one of those people who think that the House is gone right now. But I think that there's a very good chance that Republicans will not suffer the kind of massive losses that we saw in 2010 or in 1994, and I see signs that, you know, of a blown opportunity for Democrats, meaning Democrats with a majority but not by a massive margin. So here's how that would work if it remained close, if the Dems just barely won, or if Republicans hung on by the skin of their teeth. I mean, I think the faint outline is something like, when you look at the polls, you can see that voters still prefer Republicans in a number of very important subject areas. They trust Republicans more. Among them, the economy, national security. We have an economy that's going, you know, pretty well in a lot of places. So you've got that. And historically, that has been pretty good for incumbents when you see that. I think you can see where the president, you know, once you get outside the suburbs, where the president is obviously a toxic presence, in whether it's a Republican district or and especially in a Democratic district. But once you get out of the metropolitan areas into the rural areas and into some of the exurban areas, mostly rural areas, though, where we have lots of congressional seats that are in play, the president is much more popular out there. And so he is not the anchor that he is in other places. And so, I mean, I think when you have all that, when you have the dollars that are being spent by Congressional Leadership Fund, they're almost like the cavalry coming in. I don't know that they can save a lot of incumbents, given the numbers that, you know, the stunning, remarkable numbers that Elena just walked us through. But they have a ton of money. They are spending, just spending and spending and spending on negative ads on Democratic candidates, hanging Nancy Pelosi, who has historically proven to be very successful as a boogeyman in Republican ads. So there's lots of Democratic candidates who are getting hammered with her at the moment right now. And so, you know, then you kind of, you know, cross your fingers if you're a Republican candidate, hope that the president doesn't, say something that's going to blow you out of the water, some new craziness. And the other thing to keep in mind is the generic ballot, you know, it's back and forth right now. It's a little bit wider than it has been. But, you know, if that generic ballot near the end, near Election Day, is, you know, maybe under 9 points. And by generic ballot, I mean the typical ballot preference where a voter gets asked, who's your preference for Congress? Who would you vote for right now, Democrat or Republican? And if that generic ballot number is under 9, in my mind, other people have different numbers, but I think if it's like under 9 or maybe even like under 7, like, you know, maybe Republicans can hold on. You know, I don't find it an especially convincing argument, but I do think you can make it plausibly.
Elena, you've been digging a little bit in the past few days, and we mentioned you just got back from Minnesota, into like the district by district look at this question. And there are a couple districts in Minnesota that are particularly important in terms of Republicans' hopes to maybe pull an upset and hold on to the House.
Right. So there are two districts in Minnesota where if Republicans hold the House, they have to win. It has to start there. There are two rural districts that sort of ancestrally Democratic.
One also currently Democratic.
And currently Democratic. One is the open seat where Tim Walz left it in southern Minnesota to run for governor. And in northern Minnesota, where Rick Nolan decided to retire as opposed to running for re-election again. And those are both places where Republicans look pretty good. I would argue maybe Minnesota 8 more so. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee just pulled all of their IE spending, so all of their TV ad reservations in the district there. And that's usually a pretty good sign if you follow the money as to where the party actually thinks the likelihood of it flipping. So I think Minnesota 8 is looking pretty tough for Democrats right now. Minnesota 1 is still very much in a dogfight. But sort of one element that I would layer over Charlie's sort of really sort of well, you know, sort of detailed how Republicans hold on to this. One more element that I hear constantly from Democrats is that redistricting is a huge part of why this is, that Democrats may not actually see as big of a, you know, quote unquote wave as one would imagine given the first midterm year after Trump was elected. Republicans were able to win in wave elections in 2010, and that in, not only in congressional races but also legislative, and redrew the maps in a way that made it incredibly difficult for Democrats to make gains. And so the sort of the playing field is a lot smaller than it was in 2010 or in 06 or in 94. There are just fewer opportunities for Democrats to make inroads. And so I think that that's also why there are fewer opportunities for Republicans to make inroads like Minnesota 1 and Minnesota 8, because they've taken over so much of it at this point. But I do think that if Republicans win, it's got to start in these sort of rural blue-collar districts.
Democratic districts. Flipping them, exactly. Building up a little bit more of a cushion instead of 23 seats, 25 seats. And then pulling out a bunch of like 1 or 2 point wins in some places where Republicans drew the district a few years ago, and that wall holds and protects them.
Well, and I think that there's still about 24 districts that are sort of split between suburban and rural areas. So think Ohio 12, think Illinois 12. These are places where it's sort of the, take Ohio 12 because we've talked about it in the past. There was the special election between Danny O'Connor and Troy Balderson, sort of fades from the Columbus suburbs out into, stretches out into Zanesville and into very rural parts of Ohio. That's a place where if Democrats drive up suburban turnout, independents go their way, they can flip a district like that, even though it's pretty red. But if, say, the president has a pretty good couple of weeks, there's not a lot of chaos, as Charlie described, coming out of the White House, then they could very easily hold on to places like that. So those are the sorts of districts that are really on the knife's edge and could at this point still kind of go either way.
One point that I also forgot to mention was the business about enthusiasm. Obviously, Democratic enthusiasm, we see all sorts of signs of grassroots energy on the left, and that Democratic enthusiasm is through the roof. But it's also important to note that Republican enthusiasm is pretty high too. You know, when you look at the polling, it shows you they're totally jazzed up. The Republican base is jazzed up. It's just that they're not quite at Democratic levels right now. And I think the gap between them, the delta, is going to be really, really interesting here. But I do want to push back a little bit against the redistricting point. I think it's super smart and it applies in some states. But I think it's becoming a total crutch that Democrats rely on. They're like, oh, poor us. We're redistricted out of everywhere. You know what? That is just a crutch. Like, they point to 1994. In 1994, most of those maps were gerrymandered by Democratic legislatures, you know, and Republicans blew through it because of the historical forces that were at play. And if you look at the 2006 wave, you know, it was, you know, more balanced. It wasn't that Democrats had gerrymandered all the legislatures, but, you know, it was a more even mix. Now, I think where this point does come in is after 2010 is where you began to see Republicans then understand the power of controlling so many state houses. And you do see some states where it's going to – Elena's point is right on the money, where no matter how strong the winds are, they're going to really have a difficult time ousting some of these Republican incumbents.
I think the interesting thing about the redistricting and the gerrymandering argument to me is that I agree, Charlie, that – it is used as a crutch sometimes. I don't know if I agree with you quite all the way, but I think the thing that's interesting about this, and Elena, you've written about this, is that these maps were drawn for a different conception of the Republican coalition.
Right.
These this was drawn using the 2011 understanding of who Republican voters were and how solid they were. And Donald Trump blew that up in a lot of places in 2016. And we're now seeing the suburbs in a lot of places much more in play than they ever were, and rural areas much less in play than they ever were. So it's this kind of odd mix.
Yeah, no, it's very much reliant on data and on the way that a state looked 10 years ago. And we're right at the cusp of a new redistricting year in 2020. And so we're going to see that sort of once again change and readdress sort of these same sorts of things. But I don't know. I mean, I take Pennsylvania. I mean, that's a place where the maps were drawn in such a way that, what was it, Republicans had 15 of the 18, or I don't remember what exactly it was. But bottom line, that it was pretty unrepresentative of a state that is a 50-50 state. And North Carolina is the same way. So
I think it was 13 out of the 18.
Okay, so maybe that's slightly better.
Mm-hmm. I think that's better. But also, you know, if you look at the map 10 years earlier, my point is that things change over time, in part because parties change. And there was a heavily gerrymandered Pennsylvania map in, you know, from the 2002 to 2012. And oftentimes you see this, you saw it in Pennsylvania, saw it in Georgia in the 90s. A map is drawn under one conception, as Scott mentioned, and things change. New people move in.
Right.
Parties change. People lash out. Bad candidates run. You know, there's all sorts of variables like that that suddenly change all the equation, particularly, you know, in the suburbs, which have you know, seen, I think, have been much more fluid than some other areas.
Elena, really quick before we get out of this segment, what are you going to be watching as the House expert here? You know, what's the data point that you are going to be keeping an eye on to gauge the direction of the race for the House over the next 3 weeks as we close in on the election?
That's a great question. I think what I'm going to be watching in particular is where the committees and the outside groups are adding and taking away their spending. So this week we saw two movements. So the DCCC, as I mentioned, pulled out of Minnesota 8 and pulled out of Florida 16, where Vern Buchanan is defending his seat. He was sort of seen initially as vulnerable because of some legislative districts underneath him had flipped, but they're pulling out of there. And then on the flip side, CLF, Congressional Leadership Fund, the GOP outside group, is now jumping back into Iowa 1, which is where Rod Blum is trying to desperately hold on to his seat, and it was sort of written off for dead, and now they're suddenly jumping back into it. And then Florida 27, which is a seat that Ileana Ross-Layton had held for decades.
This is a Cuban-American Republican.
Cuban-American Republican in a very blue district that Hillary Clinton won, just ran away with in 2016. But they are now putting in a buy there, Republicans are, because even though it sort of has Democrat written all over it, the woman who's running there is a Hispanic woman who's been on Hispanic TV for a long, long time and is really giving Donna Shalala, who arguably is a pretty old, elderly candidate and also not Hispanic herself.
She is empirically elderly. I don't think we need to argue the point. She's going to be the second oldest House freshman ever if she wins.
Okay, I'm just trying to be
diplomatic.
Good to my elders. So bottom line, that these are places where were sort of written off initially, and now all of a sudden CLF is spending there. So I think that those are always great leading indicators as to where the map is going and what's competitive and what isn't anymore.
All righty. Thank you very much, Elena. I appreciate you coming in to talk us through that.
No problem.
Charlie, I know that you're going to be staying put for segment two. Coming up, we're going to be talking about Donald Trump, president, campaigner, insult comic. But first, we're going to break for a brief word from a sponsor.
Today's episode is sponsored by AARP. The latest issue of Politico magazine series, The Deciders, takes a look at voters over 50 in Pennsylvania who are being crushed by the cost of healthcare. It doesn't matter if they are Republican or Democrat. They don't see hope for themselves or for future generations and are voting for help. View the latest Politico AARP poll results and read the latest issue of The Deciders at politico.com/thedeciders. Money, 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 money,
money. Okay, that was Donald Trump's walkout music when he was a character on World Wrestling Entertainment, the old WWE. Which brings us to our next data point, four. Donald Trump has four rallies set for just the next 5 days. He's really spending a lot of time out on the campaign trail now, trying to boost fellow Republicans heading into the midterm elections. And so we're going to get to the president's penchant for entertainment and theatrics that was on display on reality TV all those years and how it plays into the character that he's built up in the White House and as the central protagonist now in the Republican Party, basically, in the story that is the Republican Party. So we have here with us Andrew Restuccia, who covers the White House for Politico. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going pretty well. How about you?
Good.
All right. So, Andrew, you've done something a little different than I think your normal assignment over the last few weeks. You've been almost forensically analyzing the president's showmanship. And as part of that, his sense of humor, which I think is something people don't think about a lot, but which plays a pretty important part in his public persona, and especially these rallies that he's doing so many of now to try and gin up his fans before the midterms. And something that stuck with you, which is the reason we're talking to you today, is that Donald Trump has what you might call good comedic timing. What are some examples of that? Talk us through what you mean.
Yeah, and I think it's important to start with, I mean, there are many Donald Trumps, and there are many Donald Trumps that show up at any given time, right? I mean, talking to people in the White House, he's not known as a sort of funny guy behind the scenes. He's pretty serious. When he does say things that are funny, they tend to be sort of cutting uncharitably, you'd call them a little bit mean-spirited. He's been known to sort of cut aides down to size in a funny way, you know, which is sort of a bizarre mix of things, right? I think the best example of this that we can see with our own eyes is at these rallies. So like you said, he's going to be all over the place over the next couple days. You know, when you write down the words, when you read a transcript of the words that he says, they don't come off as particularly, you know, funny. But when you see him do them in person, you know, they sometimes are. He has a way of sort of pausing and using his hands and gesticulating.
Don't worry about that baby. I love babies. So I love babies. I hear that baby crying. I like.
Waiting a beat for the moment to hit.
Actually, I was only kidding. You can get the baby out of here.
And the people that are around him, the crowd really goes crazy for this.
Right. This is something that the crowd eats up. This gets to the point of his appeal, I think, and like how he maintains the fan base that he has, which obviously we all know, you know, we can all read the polls and see that more people dislike him than like him. And the people who really dislike him outnumber the people who really like him. But there is this fan base that's there, and this is part of the connection.
Yeah, and I think that people are sort of speaking two different languages here. That, you know, his supporters see and interpret and the things that he says in a totally different way than you or I might, or you know, the rest of his critics might. I mean, you know, talking to people for this story that I'm working on, I spoke to comedians and other people, and you know, there's a debate about whether the things that the president says are funny at all, right? Like in any way, right? But if you talk to people who go to his rallies, I mean, they really are speaking a different language than everybody else. I mean, they interpret the things that he says totally differently, and with, you know, much more humor involved, I would say.
Ooh, there was a mosquito. I don't want mosquitoes around me. I don't like mosquitoes. I don't like those mosquitoes. I never did. Okay, speaking of mosquitoes, hello, Hillary. How are you doing?
Charlie, you were an early Trump rally attendee back during the primaries in 2016, original recipe Trump rallies.
Hoogie Trump.
I would call him. What was your impression?
Well, I thought he was pretty funny when I saw him on the trail in 2016 in New Hampshire, and I think I saw him in Iowa too. I saw him a couple times. And what I remember is that he was much funnier than I expected. I thought there was sort of a wry sense of humor, and he had these funny observations on sort of the artificiality of the political class and the absurdity of the political process. And so that was really entertaining, and I was surprised and didn't expect that. He also kind of reminded me of that, you know, that older inappropriate uncle you have who's really funny but also totally capable of saying the most cringy things. And those were my takeaways from the rallies. But now when I see it, when I watch him, you know, it's still recognizable. He's still a recognizable character, but in my mind, at least, the narcissism and the self-aggrandizing and the egomania has caught up to him. And to me, it seems like he's only funny to the base, which eats up the Hillary Clinton jokes and the mockery of the enemies and opponents. And to me, that's not really humor. He's not drawing on the same reservoir that he once did. I mean, there's almost like a darker side to it.
Well, I think, and Andrew, you kind of got into this at the beginning, right? His humor, to the extent that he is humorous, it's cutting.
Exactly.
Right? It's in opposition to someone. It's about, you said cutting an aide down to size, but cutting anyone down to size. I'm thinking about like his political enemies at these rallies. A lot of the comments he's made about women who have opposed him are viewed as funny by his fans.
You've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals. Your Twitter account
only
is
Rosie
several...
O'Donnell.
Very much not so by others, but it's all about bringing down, not all, it's a lot about bringing down enemies.
Yeah, I mean, he's been really critical of the Me Too movement. You know, at one of his recent rallies, he said something like, I can't say Pennsylvania is the woman that got away. I have to say person. And like, that's not really a joke, right? I mean, there's no punchline there, really. It's not like a traditional joke setup, but it's the type of thing that gets people really going. I mean, one thing that I thought was really fascinating at one of his recent rallies is he does this new impression of Dianne Feinstein, also sort of mean-spirited, also very cutting.
Did you leak the document? What? No, I didn't leak. Well, wait 1 minute. No, we didn't leak.
But he's so observant about everything, right? He's able to pick up on these little moments, and he's really focused on this moment from the hearing with Christine Blasey Ford when Dianne Feinstein was being accused basically of leaking this private letter. And she at one point turns to her staff and says, "Did we leak it?" You know, and the staff says, "No, we definitely didn't leak it." And she says, "No." And he recreates that moment and lampoons her and caricatures her in a really effective way, you know, because it was a, you know, kind of embarrassing moment for Dianne Feinstein that she couldn't have just publicly said, "We definitely didn't do it," you know.
See, here's the thing I'm wondering. You just mentioned how observant President Trump is in being able to kind of notice the intricacies of a scene like that and recreate it. But how self-aware is he, given that, I mean, this is not a guy who makes fun of it. Actually, I shouldn't say that. He, especially in recent days, he has made fun of himself a few more times, which I thought was notable, but he's not someone prone to self-reflection.
Yeah, he is not self-deprecating. He's not self-reflective. You know, even people who are his defenders in the White House acknowledge that. He almost never turns the microscope on himself. And, you know, that is, you know, in his defense, that is something that that his supporters love, right? The fact that he is kind of an unapologetic defender of himself and everyone around, and his ideology is his sort of way of thinking. But yeah, you're right. I mean, he's not particularly self-reflective. There are a couple examples that go against that statement. I mean, he's sort of made fun of himself for not drinking and said, "Can you imagine if I had been drinking, how horrible would it be?" But those are really exceptions to the rule. I mean, he doesn't do this very often. And
even in that instance, he's holding himself up in comparison to someone else, right?
Right.
It's not like it is a self-deprecating moment, but only in a vacuum, right? It's like the whole context of that is he was comparing. He was basically saying that the guy he nominated at the Supreme Court had a problem with alcohol,
right?
At that point, or used to have a problem.
And
with
he
alcohol.
Usually only makes those self-deprecating comments in safe spaces, which is a phrase that he would personally hate that I used in reference to him. But you know, whether it's at the White House or at a rally, occasionally at a rally he'll make some sort of joke about, you know, like, you know, if you go early vote, you don't have to listen to me anymore. Like little things like that. But it's only when he's surrounded by people who adore him. You know, you're not seeing those self-deprecating comments come up very often in, you know, one-on-one back and forth with journalists, for example.
And Charlie, this is something that you've talked about a lot in past shows. It gets to the insecurity issues here in terms of where this is all coming from.
Yeah, I mean, I was sort of laughing myself as you mentioned the president's not particularly self-reflective. I mean, we all know he's not self-reflective right. at all. The guy doesn't read. He doesn't think much. Like in my mind, I envision his brain, it's like, what are the seagulls in Finding Nemo, you know? Like you watch it a million times. I've watched it a million times with my kids.
Mine.
And like that's what's going on in his head in a lot of ways, I think. And so sometimes because of that, he probably he isn't able to harness it for productive uses. You know, I think he early Trump was not as mean in what he would focus on. He was talented, and this is in some ways his political superpower. Think about what he was able to do to his opponents. He zeroed in right away and made fun in a way that connected with the Republican primary audience. The fact that Jeb Bush didn't have energy, or that Marco Rubio was little, you know, and he just nailed them one after another, and they loved the fact that he was willing to puncture all these Republican sacred cows. Now, to me, it's moved into a sort of a darker realm where he harnesses the energy for something other than entertainment purposes. And that's a little...
And I think you're right, and I think that's partly because, you know, being president, he feels under attack from all sides in a way that he didn't even during the campaign. And, of course, he was under attack during the campaign as well. But now he really feels like, I think in a lot of ways, the walls are closing in on him. And that brings out this side of him that is, which has always been there, frankly, you know, at times. But it comes out a lot more, this sort of mean-spirited, cutting, aggressive, you know, and... You know, it's even difficult to describe what he's doing as a sense of humor, right? Because it really is a political attack.
It is a political attack, and I'm almost thinking of the, and you know, I'm not an expert in this area, but I from what I've read about the way, you know, when scientists are trying to get like a laser up to higher intensity, they bounce it back and forth between some mirrors that are sitting next to it, and it gets brighter and brighter, and it's like he and his base are kind of just like playing off each other in a way that's like amplifying this type of humor that really only plays to them. And this is a guy who was in show business for, I mean, as we, you know, we're playing the clips, we're talking about it here. He was in show business for a lot of years. There are a lot more people who used to find him funny than I think find him funny now.
Everybody's always blaming me for everything.
But I think like so many other things at this moment, when you think someone or something is funny, including the president, has a lot to do with where your politics are at this point, not just because your perception of them is skewed by the political views, but because their, and in this case, Trump's targeting of this humor is very finely tuned to the people who already like him.
I think that you're right. And there are, I mean, there are legitimate moments even in rallies now that are just sort of like, chuckle to yourself.
Objectively funny. Empirically
things that
funny.
He does,
Andrew Restuccia says
I think,
it's funny.
So at least. But, you know, talking to people for this story, Democrats in particular, I mean, tribalism has become such a huge part of like our politics right now. And you know, people just refuse to see it, right? And people aren't, and a lot of people aren't, who are critics of Trump, aren't sitting down and actually watching what he does, right? So talking to comedians, talking to people who've written WHCA or White House Correspondents Association speeches, I mean, people won't even really get into the conversation, right? Like that's how divided people are right now.
You said you talked to comedians and other people who, you know, experts in humor. On the flip side, right, I think probably a lot of Trump fans don't find a lot of professional comedians very funny right now either, right? Like I think a lot of them are tuning out the late night shows that have kind of lampooned Trump
right.
at every occasion.
You know, and Trump himself doesn't find that stuff very funny and takes it very personally,
not.
Right?
He doesn't think it's funny.
He doesn't personally, he's not able to make fun of himself. And in fact, you know, a really sort of formative moment for him was the, I think, 2011 or 12 White House Correspondents Association mm-hmm. dinner in which Seth Meyers and Barack Obama ruthlessly mocked him.
Donald Trump has been saying that he will run for president as a Republican, which is surprising since I just assumed he was running as a joke.
And he came away from that feeling, you know, sort of more determined than ever to prove himself in the political sphere. And, you know, this is very much an issue of debate, but like people have said that even was one of the many factors that drove him to run for president in the first place. So, yeah, we can thank Seth Meyers and Barack Obama maybe for what we have right now.
And that
now,
was
and
brutal.
Now here we are.
It was.
Oh, wow. I was there and it was, everybody was cringing. It was so bad. I mean, it was just a devastating indictment of Trump.
It was.
All right. Well, Andrew, thank you very much for coming in through the studio here to talk us through. through that story that you've been working on. It's a little off your normal beaten path, but it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, thanks. And thanks for having me.
All right. And Charlie, thank you for being here as always.
Thank you, Scott.
Is this the part where I get all I ever wanted? Who said that? Can I get my money back?
All right, that was a great show this week. As promised, before we say goodbye, we are going to turn things over briefly to one Nerdcast superfan to take us through the credits. And this week we've got Laura Hubka of Iowa's 1st District. Charlie, tell us about Iowa's 1st District.
Well, it would border on Minnesota, southern Minnesota, and that would be represented by Rod Blum of Northeast Iowa.
Very strong. Laura, take it away.
Nerdcast is produced by Michaela Rodriguez, with help from Adrian Hurst. Dave Shaw is the executive producer, and their illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you like Nerdcast, and you're listening on Apple Podcasts, rate the show and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show.
Thank you, Laura. Listeners, we found Laura because she emailed in to say she was a fan. If you are a fan of the Nerdcast who wants to read the credits, please let us know. Shoot an email to nerdcast@politico.com. Once again, thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you again next week.
Born in the USA. Oh, just a little born in the USA. Save me, President Jesus, I'm born in the USA. How did it happen? Born